Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. A couple of months ago, I was reading, I think it was the LA Times, and I read a review of this book called The Lost City of Z. I had never heard about it before, read the review, though, and I just knew it was something that Coast listeners would enjoy and that I'd enjoy reading. One reviewer said of its protagonist, he could outmarch Lara Croft and outthink Indiana Jones. Another wrote, hordes of mosquitoes, poison arrow attacks, bizarre and fatal diseases, spies in starched collars, hidden outposts of Atlantis. What's not to like? The Lost City of Z is like a wonderful 19th century tale of exotic danger, but it goes on to say it also sheds light on new archaeological research that's exploding our preconceptions of the Amazon and its peoples. David Grant is the writer. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show tonight.
Hey, I got to tell you, I love this book.
Oh, it's good to hear.
And it's becoming a movie, right?
It's becoming a movie. It was optioned by Brad Pitt's production company, and Brad Pitt is slated to play the main character, this protagonist you described.
I thought he was going to play you.
No, that would be a stretch even for him.
I say this, and you sort of included it in the book. You sort of poke fun at yourself in pointing out that you're an unlikely guy to channel Alan Quatermain or something, right? You're not a big game hunter. You don't go camping. And yet you took the ultimate camping trip, risk your own life. How does a New York writer get so hooked on a story to put everything on the line like that?
Well, yeah, as you describe, and I definitely, as they say in the business, have a face for radio, a body for radio. A little bit pudgy around the middle, a bit out of shape. I suffer from keratoconus, which is a degenerative eye condition that makes me pretty much blind at night. And I tend, as I describe in the book, to get lost even on the subway to work in Times Square. And so the notion of me in the middle of the jungle was about as unlikely as something I never imagined, to be perfectly honest. And when I began looking into this story, I began it much more as a biographical quest, investigating the story of this legendary British explorer, this kind of one of the last great Victorian and Edwardian explorers, who had disappeared in the Amazon in 1925 looking for an ancient city which he had called somewhat cryptically the City of Z. And it was only as I began to do more research, going around the world, looking in libraries and archives in a forum much more suited for my paltry attributes, physical attributes, that I began to get really consumed with the story. And at one point I had gone to Wales, and I had tracked down Fawcett. That was the British explorer. His name was Percy Harrison Fawcett. I tracked down his granddaughter, and we chatted for a long time. And at one point, she showed me in a back room an old chest, and she opened up the old chest. Inside this old chest were all these old books, and the bindings were breaking apart, and they were covered in dust. They were held together by these little bows and ribbons, and I asked her what they were, and she said, well, those were my grandfather's secret diaries and logbooks.
Wow.
And these books really held enormous clues both to the mystery of Fawcett's life and to the mystery of his death. And it was really at that point where I decided to do something foolish and head into the jungle myself.
Well, I mean, maybe you didn't know it at the time how lucky it turned out that you were able to convince them to let you see those journals, because as we're going to learn over the course of the next 2 hours, a lot of people tried this same journey and didn't come back. But there were clues in there that maybe this guy, Fawcett, was misleading people in the course of the clues he left behind.
That's right. That's right. Fawcett, he just to give the listeners a little bit of background.
Yeah.
He had begun exploring the Amazon in 1906, and he originally went to the Amazon, which was back then. And just to give the listeners a sense of its size, it's about the size of the continental United States. This enormous wilderness area. And back then, it was really the last large kind of blank space on the map, at least for outsiders. And Fawcett had been sent in to map the interior. And at that time, the area was so unknown that the countries of Brazil, Peru, and Bolivia, they didn't even know where their borders were in the interior. So they needed someone to come in and survey it. And so Fawcett was given this task. He had trained as a surveyor at the Royal Geographical Society in London. And he was sent in, and over the next several years, he mapped this area, and he began to gather clues that led him to believe that the jungle contained this ancient civilization. He found, for example, once in the Bolivian floodplains, he was climbing these large earth mounds, and he saw something sticking out of the ground, and when he bent down, he picked it up. It was a shard of pottery. Now, this was in an era before carbon dating, but it looked very old and very brittle. And when he looked out between these earth mounds, and there were several of them, he saw what he said and described were what he thought were causeways buried underneath the jungle floor. And so he gathered these clues and other clues, and then eventually in 1925 he sent out to find this place. Now, most people thought he was a crank, that he was a lunatic, that the jungle was simply too inhospitable a place to support a complex society, that there could not be a Mayan or an Incan civilization in the middle of the jungle. But he believed he was right, and he set out to find it. He brought with him just two people, his older son Jack, who was 21, had his 22nd birthday in the jungle, and Jack's best friend Raleigh Rimel. Off they went, and Fawcett would write dispatches describing his experience as he moved in the jungle, and he would give these pieces of paper to Indian runners who would carry them out of the jungle. And in kind of a very pre-modern form of Twitter, these pieces of paper would be carried from one outpost to another outpost and then typed up on telegraph machines, so that millions of people around the world were following this expedition, and the dispatches emerged for 5 months, and then they ceased.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, because I want to come back to the archaeological aspects of it and anthropological aspects of it.
Sure.
But tell me more about Percy Fawcett, because he was like a rock star, as you describe. I mean, people all over the world were following his exploits. I mean, he was the quintessential explorer, the ramrod spine of an Englishman, stiff upper lip, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, when you look at his picture, I mean, and I have a picture of him in the book, I mean, it's right out of, I mean, you couldn't imagine. I mean, he just fit everything with the mustache and the kind of burning, intense eyes. People said his eyes burned like a visionary. And he was extraordinarily famous in his day. He was an enormous legend. Even before 1925 on this final expedition, stories of his adventures in the jungle captivated the public's imagination, how he would battle electric eels and piranha and all sorts of predators, how he would emerge from these regions that nobody had come back from with maps. And most particularly about him, he seemed to be able to survive almost any conditions. He was seen as almost indestructible. Indeed, some people even speculate in his day that he was immune to death, because he would go on these expeditions. He would usually take about a dozen men, and usually half his party would die of disease and starvation. And you have to understand that this was in an era, even though it was, you know, just a century ago, but it was an era before all these kind of inoculations. And so yellow fever and malaria, and most of his men would succumb to these diseases, and he would always emerge intact.
And like getting sick out there, as you describe in the book, The Lost City of Z, getting sick out there or breaking your foot or getting bit by a snake, I mean, it's like a death sentence, because they wouldn't stop. He's on these missions, and if you get sick or you're down, you stay there.
Oh, yeah. There were two things. I mean, one, Fawcett really let nothing stand in his way of his goal or his object. And so he would not let weaker men slow him down. But the other thing was, they were in such vast areas that if you became sick or weak, they couldn't carry you out. And if they tried to, it would imperil the whole party. And so his men, before they set out on these expeditions, all agreed to a rule that Fawcett enforced, which is that if you became too weak or sick, you would have to be abandoned in the jungle.
Let's talk about the jungle for a minute, because that was really a fascinating part of what you explore in the book. And it's just how stark it is out there. And it sort of goes to the heart of the argument that there could never be a civilization out there, any kind of major civilization, because there's not enough food. It's deceptive in that it's lush and green, and you might think there's all kinds of food and you can live off the land. But as Fawcett and his teams learned, that's very deceptive, dangerously deceptive.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that surprised me when I began doing this research, and it was something I didn't know. I mean, it never occurred to me that starvation would be a major threat in the jungle. You think of this kind of place that's so bountiful. You think of all this flora and fauna. And yet, partly because of the competition for nutrients in the soil among plants, and because of flooding, the soil is often drained of nutrients. And so there are not a lot of crops. And this was one of the theories that led people to think, well, there couldn't be a complex society because there wouldn't be enough food to support a large population, which would be a precursor to any complex society. The other thing that happens is that the animals, the predators in the jungle, are so well adapted to this environment. They have been there for so long that they camouflage themselves. They are more elusive. And that humans, especially humans who have not been in the jungle or lived in the jungle, like these external expeditions that would come in, were simply outmatched. They were simply outwitted. And rather than becoming predators looking for food, they often became prey.
And the descriptions you have, for example, when he goes on this mission to map the one of the borders, Bolivia, Peru, I believe, and you describe what it was like. It was like a wild frontier because they had this rubber boom that was going on out there, and it was lawless, and people would just shoot you down for looking at them the wrong way, in addition to disease and snakes and all kinds of really strange and dangerous creatures that you wouldn't find anywhere else on the planet.
Yeah. I mean, at that point when Foster was exploring the Amazon, this is another factor that made it extremely dangerous, was there was this rubber boom. Rubber had become in great demand in industrial countries because of the development of the car and bicycles, and so for tires, Goodrich, Goodyear, and all this kind of stuff. And so Amazon at that point was the one place where rubber came from, and it would be tapped from these trees. But this was very difficult work. And labor supply was often in short. And so rubber barons would send in their men to enslave the Indians, the Native Americans that lived in the wilderness areas. And if they weren't enslaved, they were often massacred. And it was extremely bloody. And Fawcett, even though he had inherited many of the racial prejudice of Victorian society, was appalled by this, that the Indians were treated in this manner. And it also made his work extremely dangerous because of this bloody contact. Many of the tribes became very hostile to anyone who was entering their territories because of the fear and threat. And so this made it very perilous for Fawcett to enter these areas. And one of the things that made Fawcett very unusual for that time period is that, unlike these rubber barons or other explorers who came into the area, he refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances. And I found one of Fawcett's colleagues' diaries in which he described, who was with him, a companion, in which he describes how Fawcett ordered his men to literally sing God Save the Queen while he marched forward with his hand above his head into a fusillade of arrows.
David Grant is the author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, in which he sort of recreates the steps taken by this amazing explorer, Percy Fawcett. When we come back, I want to get into the subject of the Fawcett freaks, because I wasn't exaggerating. This guy Fawcett was sort of a rock star of his time. And then we'll pick up the story of the Lost City of Z, what it really means. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. 85 years ago, an English explorer, sort of the English explorer named Percy Fawcett, led an expedition into the darkest heart of the Amazon, trying to find what he called the Lost City of Z, and he never came out. And in the decades since, a lot of other expeditions have been staged to find out what happened to Fawcett, and a lot of those people didn't come out either. Our guest, David Grann, retraced some of those steps, took that same journey himself, wrote a book about it, The Lost City of Z. When we come back, what is the Lost City of Z, and is it really there? Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, I'm George Knapp. My guest is David Grann, author of this book, The Lost City of Z. David, before we get into the city itself, tell me a little bit more about Fawcett. I don't want to oversell this, but the guy, he was a major celebrity of his time, right?
Yeah, he really was. He was known as the David Livingston of the Amazon, he later, even before 1925, when he set out for Z, he helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. In fact, that's how I came across Fawcett's name to begin with and began to look into his story. And he really did. He captivated the imagination. He was kind of the last of this kind of individualist explorer. It was kind of him against the forest. It was kind of, even though it was the early 20th century, it was still essentially pre-modern expeditions where you did not have technology. You did not have ways to kind of communicate out from the Amazon. You did not have any kind of medical protection. In fact, I read many of the manuals that Fawcett had studied to become an explorer, and they would teach you, for example, if you were bitten by a poisonous snake, to take gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and ignite it, or if you were hit by a poisonous arrow, to take boiling grease and pour it into the wound to help cauterize it. So this was still a very, you know, even though it wasn't that long ago, medical conditions, all these things were still at a very basic level. And so these expeditions really did capture the imagination. It was also the growth of cities everywhere else. And so this idea that there was still this place, this wilderness area that remained unknown, captivated the imagination, and the Amazon in particular.
Yeah, and that people had crazy ideas, like they thought the Amazonians had their heads in their stomachs or something like that.
So Walter Raleigh. Yeah, I mean, essentially, from the moment the first conquistadors had arrived in South America in the 1500s, early 1500s, they heard stories about the Amazon, and it captivated their imagination. And of course, the most famous legend of all was of El Dorado, this purportedly city that was so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder and anointed their bodies with it so that they were gleaming in the sun.
And Cortez and Pizarro, all those guys went looking for it.
They lusted for gold, the conquistadors, and the soonest they heard a rumor, they quickly rounded up several thousand men. There was 4,000 of them. They enslaved many Indians, and they headed over the Andes, descended into the jungle, and really were not prepared for the conditions. I mean, a lot of the conquistadors wore armor into the jungle, which had to be the most foolish idea possible, and most of them perished. On that first expedition in search for El Dorado, some 4,000 men went, and nearly all of them died of disease and starvation.
And is El Dorado the city of Z? I mean, I know that Z is sort of like Percy Fawcett's shorthand version of his secret name for this city, right?
Yes, and I mean, there is without question a connection. Fawcett, when I described earlier him looking for clues in the jungle, and one of the way he looked for clues to try to figure out could there really be an ancient civilization in the jungle was he actually read a lot of the early chronicles from the first El Dorado hunters. So, for example, on that first expedition of Pizarro and Orellana, a few men made it out, including a priest who wrote an account. And other El Dorado expeditions, usually a few people would make it out, and they would write these chronicles describing what they had seen in these expeditions. And Fawcett studied those chronicles for clues, because even though the chronicles never describe finding this golden city, the first conquistadors into the Amazon had described seeing large populations, seemingly sophisticated societies, roads, bridges, causeways, pottery, things that later explorers who went to the Amazon never saw. And so Fawcett used these chronicles, and they were some of the clues that helped him lead him to this notion that, yes, the jungle really did contain remnants of an ancient civilization.
And is it because of those first explorers that the subsequent explorers didn't find anything? Because the first guys brought diseases and wiped out the...
Yes. I mean, I think that was certainly Fawcett's theory. And I think when we talk a little bit later about could this place exist, I think some of the findings certainly confirm that. And that Fawcett's theory was that disease had helped annihilate large swaths of the populations. And so when explorers came in and didn't see these large populations and they didn't see these societies, they concluded that was the way the jungle really always was. And Fawcett believed that wasn't the case, that they were actually looking at societies that have been devastated from disease. And we could talk a little bit more about that, but other evidence certainly confirms that.
As you start pursuing the story, you go to the Royal Geographic Society, which I tell you, your stuff was really interesting. You could write a whole book about that. I mean, they had the audacious idea that, hey, let's go ahead and map the entire world, and we're going to train guys like Fawcett and send them out to do this work.
Yeah, I mean, who knew that, again, you know, when you begin these projects, and usually when I begin these projects, you know, I knew very little when I began. And so I had no idea that there had actually been what was in effect almost like an explorer school, that people like Fawcett, Livingston, Speke, all these famous explorers, Burton, they would go to the Royal Geographic Society, which was engaged in the 19th century and early 20th century in essentially mapping out the world. And what's amazing is that even in the 19th century, there were large swaths of the planet that had not yet been mapped. I mean, even though the continents were known, parts of the interior, for example, Australia, nobody knew what was in the interior, outsiders, and there was belief that there was maybe a huge enormous lake or body of water in the middle of Australia, which turned out to be false, but all these explorers sent out from the Royal Geographic Society died pursuing it. And people who go to the Royal Geographic Society, and part of this was, out of imperialism. The British Empire was expanding. They needed good maps. They were engaged in this project, but there was also a scientific bent to it. There was also a scientific curiosity, and they would attract a lot of these explorers, usually people who did not quite fit into Victorian society or were rebelling against it, usually very eccentric characters, people like Fawcett and Burton. And off they would go. They would get trained in surveying, and they would also get trained in survival. They would be given some tools, and then they would head off into these very dangerous areas of the world.
As you pick up the story, you go to the Royal Geographic Society, and they let you see some papers, and you go to the Fawcett family, and they let you see some stuff. But everywhere you go, they give you an eye, right? At first, aha, you're one of those guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first went to the Royal Geographic Society, they kind of looked at me when I said, yeah, I'd like to see what, do you have any archives on Fawcett, any letters and correspondence, and look at his old maps. And they kind of cock one eye at me and basically, are you a Fawcett freak? And what I quickly discovered is that there were all these people who had become kind of obsessed and consumed with Fawcett, the mystery of what had happened to him and the mystery of the city. And these people would kind of come looking for clues and then head off into the jungle to essentially commit suicide. And so they all gave me these very funny looks when I began this project.
So how many missions were there? I mean, it's sort of like Elvis is still alive. Fawcett might still be alive.
I mean, partly because Fawcett was seen as so indestructible, and I think it was very hard for people to get their mind around, including Fawcett's family and his wife and Fawcett's other two children. He had three children. He took his older son with him, but he had another younger son and a daughter, and he left his wife, Nina, behind. And for the family, they really never gave up hope or pining. I mean, Nina, up until her death in 1953, Fawcett disappeared in 1925. So that's, more than 25 years later, still believe that her husband was alive. She could not believe that this man who she had known so well, who had always seemed so indestructible, could have perished.
Tell me about some of the other expeditions to find him. How soon after his disappearance did they start, and how long did they last?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things was that Fawcett had warned people not to follow him, and he believed that it was too dangerous and too perilous. And so he really had, before he left, he had said, if I can't make it, nobody can. And he had really tried to discourage any sort of rescue parties. But within a couple years, by 1928, as concerns, and there was all sorts of concerns, were they wounded? Had they found Z, they were too happy to come out. Were they kidnapped by a tribe? What was going on? And by 1928, the first large major expedition in search of Fawcett went. It was led by a man named Commander George Dyett. He was part British, part American, lived in New York. And he went to try to find him, took a large party, barely survived. His men did make it out. They were one of the lucky ones. Other parties then continued to go, and many of them disappeared and died of disease. There was a Swiss trapper who believed he had found evidence that Fawcett was being held in captivity by a tribe. He vowed to rescue Fawcett. He took with him a reporter from the UPI and a couple other members, and they were never seen again. There was even a movie star from Hollywood, a guy named Albert de Winton, although that was his stage name, who had made a cameo in King of the Wild. And he really thought he would become this Stanley to his Livingston and find him. And he set off into the jungle. Eventually, a small piece of paper emerged from the jungle, a note from him saying that he had been kidnapped by a tribe. He was never seen again as well. And just to give you some sense about how big this story was in its day. I mean, it was like you were saying, like Elvis, it was like Jimmy Hoffa. If you said, where's Jimmy Hoffa buried? If you said, where's Fawcett buried, for decades, everyone knew what you were talking about. And when that first expedition I described decided to go in 1928, Dyett put in an ad for the paper seeking a volunteer, one extra recruit he needed. And literally tens of thousands of people volunteered to go. I read their letters, which you can find in some of these archives. They came from all walks of life, captains of industries down to butlers, and they all were willing to go on this extraordinarily dangerous expedition.
And so into the breach you go. I mean, you're basically recreating a lot of those steps. You had to know what you were in for.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's amazing and is that these parties that would search for fossils, one of the things that fascinated me was that these fossil freaks weren't just going in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and 50s. They were going into the present. In fact, a large expedition set out in 1996. A Brazilian financier named James Lynch, who was also an adventurer, he also took with him his son, who was 16 years old at the time, a man named James Lynch Jr., and they went into the jungle, and they were actually captured by a tribe and held in captivity for several days before they were able to escape. And so
you found those guys. You talked to them.
I found those. And initially, you know, I thought, okay, I'll just tell their story, and I'll tell Foster's story, and I won't do this myself. But again, as I gathered these more clues, and one of the clues I discovered was when I went to Fawcett's granddaughter's house. Fawcett not only didn't want people to follow him because he was dangerous, he was also afraid in his day of rivals that one of his rivals might beat him to his discovery. He was very secretive, and he had actually been a British spy before he became an explorer. And he would literally send letters to his wife, Nina, about where he was going in code, and she had a cipher. And one of the few clues to where Fawcett had gone on his last expedition, he was going into the Mato Grosso region, which means dense forest. It was in the Brazilian Amazon. And one of the few clues was a place called Dead Horse Camp, where he had, on an earlier trip, shot one of his pack animals. Now, when I looked in Fawcett's diaries and logbooks, I found coordinates for Dead Horse Camp, but they were different from the coordinates he had released publicly. And what I had discovered and what the granddaughter confirmed is that the other coordinates he had released were simply a ruse to throw his rivals off the course. And so I realized that all these expeditions that have been searching for Fawcett often headed in the wrong direction and fatally in the wrong direction. And so it was when I was armed with these coordinates that I thought, well, if everybody went that way, what if I went this way? And so I decided to go and found a guide because even though you know, most of the world is now chartered, the Amazon still has pockets that remain unchartered. The Brazilian government estimates in the Brazilian Amazon alone there remain 60 tribes that remain uncontacted. And just a few years ago, members of a nomadic tribe emerged from the Colombian Amazon, saying they were ready to join the modern world, but they were unaware that the Colombia was a country, and they asked that the planes overhead were on these invisible roads. And so there still are areas in the jungle, you know, that are remote and isolated and involve elements that are unknown. So the first thing I had to do and the most important thing was to find a guide who could help me make contact with some of the tribes in the area where I wanted to go.
Actually, before you did that, you had to go shopping, right? You went to of this giant superstore. That's a hilarious scene in the book. Is you go to this giant camping superstore, Camping R Us in New York, and just buy everything.
That's right, yeah. I mean, as I said, I'm not a camper and not an explorer. And so, you know, under my wife's, you know, forbearance and wisdom said, you know, you're not just going, you got to at least go to one of these stores. And so I went to get every high-tech gadget I could find from GPSs to, you know, astronaut food, these, you know, ice creams that are, I don't know.
Freeze-dried?
Yeah, freeze-dried. That's it. Thank you. And packed them off with my Swiss Army knife and got everything I could go before I headed. And then I found my guide.
And then you plunge into the wilderness.
That's right. And I tried to follow Fawcett's trail as carefully as possible. Now, I had what I had been doing all for many, many months was gathering all these clues by going to these archives literally around the world and piecing together Fawcett's route as precisely as possible. And with the guide, I followed that route. And headed north into the jungle. Now, we were heading into the Xingu area. Now, and one of the interesting things was I would have Fawcett's dispatches and letters from his last trip, and I would be able to read his descriptions and kind of stay in the same places. And at one point, I knew that Fawcett had stayed on the frontier in a place called Gavot's Ranch. It was kind of, in that day, in 1925, he was a kind of a ruthless frontiersman who had pushed as far out on the frontier before the jungle. And Fawcett had stayed there. Raleigh Rymer, who was Jack's best friend, the third companion on the trip, Foote, he was already a bit sick and depleted, and then they stayed there. And so I got to that area, and I asked the Bakari Indian, the Bakari Indigenous community was in that area. I said, "Do you know Gavo's Ranch?" They said, "Oh, sure." And they took out a machete, and they led me into the forest, and they put the machete straight in the ground. And they said, "Right here." And I said, "What do you mean, right here?" They said, "No, no, it's right here." And sure enough, in that area were bricks, and they were covered by forest. And all that remained of this great ranch were bricks. And it was in that moment where I had some sense where the jungle had consumed this ranch in just a few decades. I had some sense of how remnants of a city really could disappear in the Amazon.
Meaning that there could really be something much bigger out there that had completely disappeared.
That it was really conceivable. This notion that I had seen is kind of inconceivable, you know, even though I was tempted by it and was kind of haunted by it and I found it tantalizing, it still was hard for me to imagine, like, you know, could a city disappear? Could ruins just disappear in a jungle? And when I was looking down at what the jungle and how it had ravaged this enormous place, and all that remained was bricks, I really did have some inkling that, well, this was at least conceivable. This was at least possible.
You did have hopes of at least figuring out what had happened to Fawcett. Did you also hope to maybe find some evidence or confirm the existence of something like a lost city of Z?
I did. I mean, you know, with these things, you kind of, to be honest, you feel a little nuts when you're doing it because you don't know what you're going to find. And one of the themes of the book is obsession. And Fawcett became obsessed, other people became obsessed, and to be frank, I became obsessed. And I was doing things that were very unlike me. I mean, I'm not a type of person who spends any time in the wilderness. But I was very drawn by this tantalizing possibility, by this mystery. I'm both trying to gather clues about what might happen to Fawcett. And even though I thought it was kind of a little crazy, there was still a little bit part of me that said, well, you know, could there be these ruins? Could there be something out there that was unknown, previously unknown?
In Fawcett's time, of course, he ran into all kinds of tribes that had basically never been discovered before. It had little or no contact with Europeans, cannibals. Are they still out there? Are their tribes still undiscovered, hiding?
I mean, I think I suspect that there probably are very few groups in the Amazon that haven't had at least some fleeting contact with outsiders. There are certainly tribes that the Brazilian government, for example, estimates they count, you know, 60 tribes.
David Grand, we're going to have to take a break.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to get into some of the sort of the weird sidelights of the story. For all of Percy Fawcett being a man of science, he was also involved and interested in the occult, and I want you to tell that part of it as well. Stay with us, everyone, for more of our discussion of the Lost City of Z here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Grand is my guest. He wrote this amazing book, The Lost City of Z. David, I don't want to get too far off the track about the city and your trip, but I was really surprised to find that a guy like Percy Fawcett, this model explorer, this man of science who was rigidly trained in the Royal Geographical Society in all sorts of scientific disciplines, had an interest in the occult. Tell me about it.
Yeah, he did. And part of it is to kind of understand the time period a little bit. When Fawcett became interested in the occult, especially he had lived in Ceylon in the latter part of the 19th century, before he headed off to Brazil, he actually became a Buddhist. He was a very rebellious soul, he was very curious, and interest in spiritualism was very prevalent, actually, in Victorian society. And it was among some, but it wasn't seen by everybody as antithetical to science. There was actually a belief among many scientists that this was actually another frontier that science would help peel away. And so there was actually even, there was the society set up for psychics that to look into these things in London, which had a lot of, Nobel Prize winners and famous writers. And one of the persons who Fawcett corresponded a lot with and who he was believed to be the model for one of the characters in the lost world was Arthur Conan Doyle, who was also very interested in spiritualism. Now, there were kind of two big eras of spiritualism, and I don't want to get too bogged down, but after World War I, there was also another wave of interest in spiritualism, and this came from a real longing to speak with so many people who had perished. And Fawcett fought during World War I, and his interest in the occult intensified during that period.
Did he ever actually make contact or claim to make contact?
He did. I mean, he believed that, you know, he could communicate, you know, and he would go to seances. And by the end of his life, in some ways, especially after World War I, he had been at the Battle of the Somme. And at the Battle of the Somme, you know, it was one of the most horrific battles. On the first day of battle, you know, some 20,000 British soldiers, most of them just kids, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, were marched out of these trenches across the wasteland and into machine gun fire. Fawcett had been there, he had witnessed this, and for them that was really a collapse of Western civilization. And so Fawcett's notion of Z, in some ways, became more fantastical after World War One. And when you talked about this very pragmatic scientist who had put together his clues very scientifically, after World War One, his notions of Z became more grandiose. It became more of almost a counterpoint to what he had witnessed in Europe.
And wasn't it also true, I'm trying to remember from your book, that after he disappeared, after he presumably was dead, that that his family and others tried to use seances to contact him?
That's right. Nina believed in it and attended seances. There were many, a very famous psychic in the day, a woman named E. Cummings, who would use automatic writing, wrote a famous book about Fawcett in its day, where she believed she was able to communicate and get his story about what really had happened to him. And many people attended seances trying to figure out what had happened to them. They were known as spiritual explorers, spiritual surveyors, and they would try to gather clues. And interestingly enough, to this day, when I was in Brazil, there's an area in the Mato Grosso region where a lot of mystics go. And in that area, there are various mystic groups that believe Fawcett had, in fact, found a portal to another dimension and still kind of, you know, see in Fawcett, you know, almost, he's almost like a spiritual deity in some ways.
Wow, he really is an explorer if he found that. How does the story of Atlantis fit into this?
Atlantis, in many ways, it's a little bit complicated, but this notion that the Amazon could support a complex society was seen as very unfathomable. And one of the reasons it was seen as unfathomable was because there were so many racist notions about what the Native Americans were capable of. And so one theory, Fawcett, who had grown up with all these kind of racist attitudes, was convinced when he was on the ground that the Native populations he found were very sophisticated, had advanced cultures. He was very impressed by many of the societies that he lived with and stayed with. And yet, in some ways, he to try to explain it, he sometimes thought, well, maybe they are descendants of Atlantis. Maybe that would explain that there was some European origin that would explain why these populations could have been sophisticated. And so it was for a way for him to try to square this kind of racial box he was in.
And then after he's gone, there are stories periodically popping up about white Indians, presumably his offspring.
That is right. There was, in fact, missionaries in the 40s and 50s and the late 30s began to head into some of these areas, and there began to emerge reports and rumors of a young white Indian boy staying with the Kikuru Indians, a tribe that I eventually stayed with. And eventually this boy was taken out of the jungle. He was believed to be Fawcett's grandson. They thought it was Jack's son. And he was known as the white god of the Xingu, because this was in the Xingu area of the Amazon. And he was actually, it's very sad, he was kind of paraded around almost like a circus freak, this kind of curiosity. People were lining up to watch films. There were early films of him. And eventually it was revealed that he was an albino.
Oh, clearly not
Fawcett's offspring, no.
Let's pick up the trail with pick up the story with your pursuing the trail. What did you find? What's your best guess about what happened to Fawcett, and what do you base that on?
Well, various clues led me to believe that he was likely killed by a tribe not far from the Xingu River, a little bit east of the Xingu River, heading towards a river that's known as the River of Death. And I based that on a few critical clues. One is it's very unlikely that Fawcett would have starved. By that point of his career, he was extraordinarily adept at living off the land. He was a survivor. He had adopted many of the indigenous techniques to living out the jungle. So starvation was very unlikely. While disease is a possibility, the likelihood that all three of them would have succumbed to disease also is unlikely. And then the final and the most important clue was when I eventually stayed with the Kalapalo Indians, which is a tribe in the Xingu, to my amazement, even though they don't have written records, they have oral histories. And these oral histories get passed down for generations. It's the way they preserve their past. And they had an oral history about Fawcett because they were among the first white men they had ever seen. And what's amazing about this oral history is it includes details about Fawcett that I only knew about because I had Fawcett's last letters home to Nina, including the fact that he had brought this little musical recorder, like a flute-like thing, and he had written his wife, Nina, saying, I'm bringing this with me so that I won't go mad in the solitude of the jungle. And in this oral history, it actually describes Fawcett playing this instrument. And in that oral history, it describes how Fawcett had insisted on heading east, and the Kalapalos tried to dissuade them from heading in that direction, saying in that area is what they referred to as the fierce Indians, a group of Indians that the Kalapalos, who are a very peaceful group, were very afraid of. And Fawcett insisted on going that way. And for several days, the Kalapalos described seeing Fawcett's fire rising above the canopy. And then after 5 days, the fire extinguishes as if it had been snuffed out. And they go to inspect the area, and they are gone, and nothing remains, and there's no evidence of them. And they were convinced in this oral history, and the Kalapalos know that area better than anyone, that the Indians, these fierce Indians, had killed the party.
And this is the kind of story, I mean, they're not just telling the gringo what he wants to hear. It is the kind of story that really would live on in oral traditions.
Yes, very much so. And like I said, it had enough clues in it, that details, that because I only knew them, that were verifiable, that gave me a lot of credence, gave me a lot to posit, gave a lot of credibility to their story.
And why would this tribe have killed him? What would be the range of reasons, or did they even need one?
Sure. Fawcett, who had always been able to establish peaceful contact, in the area where they were heading was the Xavante Indians. And the Xavante Indians were a group that the Brazilian government had tried to acculturate several years earlier and actually moved into camps and settlements. And they were treated horrifically and died of disease and eventually fled back into the forest. And they vowed to let nobody come in that area. And in fact, there's a long history of people who had tried to cross into those territories who were killed. And so even though Fawcett had a long, strong history of establishing peaceful contact, he was heading into an area that was extraordinarily dangerous.
Let's talk about the Lost City of Z. I mean, you don't have something where you can point, aha, exactly, that is exactly it, and I know it beyond all doubt, but even Fawcett found indications that there really could have been these large civilizations, higher ground, I guess, clearings, settlements where there might have been a couple of thousand people in each?
That's right. Eventually, I had pushed towards the Quikurus, where they had found this, at one point, this white child, this albino. And when I was there, I had met up with an archaeologist, a man named Michael Heckenberger, who had spent more than a decade doing intensive research in that area. And at one point, he had led me into the forest where there was a large moat in the earth, and it was partly excavated. And I asked him what it was. And he said, well, he had done carbon dating on it. I think this part of the moat was about 1200 AD. And I said, well, why is there a moat in the middle of nowhere? And he said, you're actually standing in a pre-Columbian settlement. And he and his team, including he worked closely with the chief of the Quikuros, a man named Afukaka, have found evidence of 20 pre-Columbian settlements. And these settlements had a population, you said, between about 2,500 to about 5,000 people. They were connected. There were several of them, and they were connected by roads built at right angles. And he had found evidence of a bridge that had crossed the riverway. And he had found lots of ancient pottery. The settlements were dated between, and I'm pretty sure it was 600 AD, it may have been 800 AD, but I believe it was 600 AD to into the 1500s, which gets back to your earlier point of could disease have wiped these people out? Well, the fact that these ancient settlements date to the 1500s, well, what happened in the 1500s? That was when the first...
We arrived.
We arrived, exactly. I mean, it's too coincidental, and this is the most logical explanation. And what's amazing is that even though conquistadors had headed into an area very far from this, it shows how quickly the disease had spread in these areas.
Tell me this. How resistant – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and Heckenberger isn't alone. So we have this settlement here, and this is in the very area where Fawcett believed he would find Z and where he disappeared. We're finding these evidence. And there are many other discoveries now, just in the last few years, using satellite imagery and ground-penetrating radar. I had described earlier these enormous earth mounds in the Bolivian floodplains that Fawcett had climbed. That's where he saw shards of pottery, and he had described seeing these causeways buried underneath the undergrowth of the forest. Well, an archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania, a man named Clark Erickson, has looked at many of these earth mounds and has concluded, in fact, they were man-made and that they were connected by causeways and roadways. They had elaborate irrigation ditches, and that these earth mounds, although it's somewhat mysterious their purpose, were most likely at least partly built to elevate themselves above some of the flooding so that you could grow crops. And he has compared the labor and the engineering that went into these earth mounds to the Egyptian pyramids. And one of the things that's interesting is that these ruins slightly go against what we would think of because they are not made of stone. There is not a lot of stone in the jungle. And it's one of the reasons they have been consumed so quickly.
Tell me this. Heckenberger, you know, you mentioned him throughout the book, and he was very helpful to you. But I wonder how resistant to this view mainstream science has been. I guess probably it's continued and maybe still continues.
Yes. I mean, and one of the things we should mention is that when Fawcett went, I mean, and this is a really important part of the story, Fawcett, who had once been this celebrated figure, when he came up with this theory, met a lot of resistance and would bang against the scientific establishment who believed that the jungle had to be a counterfeit paradise, this place that couldn't support a civilization. And he met enormous resistance. And for most of the 20th century, the Amazon was known as this term, this counterfeit paradise. That was a phrase coined by the most famous archaeologist, influential archaeologist in the Amazon, a woman named Betty Meggers. And so when Heckenberger set out, he never expected to find these things, and there was enormous resistance. And in fact, very few archaeologists went into the Amazon because people kind of thought there was nothing there. So anthropologists would go in to kind of maybe get oral traditions. But the notion of kind of going in to try to find actually archaeological ruins was not something until very recently. And the discoveries, though, in the last few years, and there was a fierce fight in the scientific establishment between some of these revisionists like Heckenberger and the traditionalists, I would say the number of discoveries now has really started to shift that debate. And, for example, a few months ago, a scientist, partly because of deforestation, using satellite imagery, had found these enormous geometric earthworks. And if somebody should try to look at these photos, if they can find them online, because they're quite extraordinary. They look like they're these enormous trenches. They're about 30 feet wide, and they extend. They look like enormous squares and triangles and circles diagrammed into the earth. They look almost like a geometric equation. They're spread out over an area more than 150 kilometers. And archaeologists, because of the similar design, they estimate the population may have been as large as 60,000, which would have made it much larger than many medieval European cities. And the carbon dating on some of these goes back 300 BC. So These discoveries are really shifting this debate, and but it's happening quickly and suddenly. And even this notion, for example, that there was no stone in the Amazon, and most of these remnants we're finding, that ARC scientists are finding, are not made of stone. And yet, not too long ago, people found what is being described as the Stonehenge of the Amazon, where there is a stone site. It looks almost like it was probably astronomical and had some purpose. And so what scientists are essentially saying is, well, we still don't know much about these civilizations, and we're only at the very beginning of this revolution. The idea that the jungle did not contain advanced civilizations, I think, is quickly becoming a dying notion.
Well, this idea that archaeologists haven't found it necessary to go into the jungle, there's all kinds of reasons not to go into the jungle,
yeah,
and you found out
too.
Those.
That's
you
true.
Discovered those. I mean, you came out unscathed, right?
I did come out unscathed. I was a bit sick, which I try not to go too much into the book because I didn't want to, you know, focus so much on that. But I did get a little bit sick. But I did come out unscathed, and there was one point on my trip where I became separated from my guide, and I was lost, and it was a short period, but it did give me some sense of the terror and what it really was like for Fawcett.
And would you go again if there was a reason for it?
You know, it's interesting. When I got done, I said never again, and I really did not think I would go again. But some of these latest discoveries are very intriguing and tantalizing to me, and so I am considering for the first time possibly another expedition, especially looking at some of these geometric earthworks that I described.
We posted an article on the Coast to Coast website tonight, images taken from Google Earth, and I think they're the same ones you're talking about, large rectangular things. Yeah.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, because it's just fascinating. And I mean, and again, you know, the purpose of these things are still unknown, and I don't think we will, you know, we're now making these discoveries, and so we're knowing there was something there. We are knowing there were larger populations. They're finding throughout the Amazon what's called black earth. Black earth is a really interesting thing. Black earth is produced from organic waste. If you have a settlement and throw things into the soil, it gets nutrients. And that means that people lived and inhabited those areas. And we're finding lots of this black earth now in the Amazon.
Save that. Hold that thought, David. We need to take a break. When we come back, I want you to tell us more about black earth. And then I want to also get into your newest book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. And we'll be opening up the phone line so that our listeners can ask you some questions as well. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. We have some time left with David Grand, my guest tonight, who wrote The Lost City of Z, as well as another book I want to touch on in a minute or two, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. David, before we leave the Amazon here, you know, this search for Z sort of began as a search for El Dorado, a city of gold. And I know there was gold in Peru and there was gold in Mexico that explorers found. Is there gold in the Amazon? Did anybody ever find gold to any degree?
You know, it's a good question. There is certainly gold in the Amazon, and gold has been mined in the Amazon and in rivers, and there are plenty of people who have searched for gold. There has not yet been found any evidence of this kind of golden city where there was kind of so much gold, where we found kind of gold statues or anything like that. That has yet to be found. I suspect it was exaggerated and somewhat of a romance, although I would say this, that, you know, so many things that we thought were impossible have since been discovered. So I'm also very careful and cautious about saying that anything at this point is impossible.
You know, you see, as we mentioned earlier, Google Earth has photos from space. Even in Fawcett's time, there was the airplanes were coming into the exploration game. It sort of takes, I guess, some of the romance out of it, but it also takes out things like cannibals and exposure to disease and things like that.
Yes, it certainly makes it much easier. And one of the interesting things was that when Fawcett went, it really was, he did really represent a certain end. And his main rival in his day was a man named Hamilton Rice. And Hamilton Rice was really kind of, if Fawcett represented kind of the end of 19th century expeditions, Hamilton Rice was kind of a harbinger of what was to come. And he, as you mentioned, brought the first airplanes into the Amazon that would land these kind of land on pontoons in the riverway.
Let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, Jacob in Susanville, California. Hi, Jacob.
Hey. I was just wondering, what are the squares in Amazon meant for?
You mean these square geometrical shapes that have been found?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think with a lot of these things, scientists still don't know. They do not yet know what the purpose of this. Was there some astronomical purpose to some of these sites where they have these trenches built in this shape? Scientists still do not yet know the purpose of them.
Like Nazca, David, do you have any theories on that? Maybe we should unleash you on that one.
Maybe that'll become my next project.
Any thoughts? Same thing?
No, I don't know. I haven't done research. I mean, I know of it, but I've never done enough research to have any kind of a hypothesis on it.
Jacob, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that was that your question?
Yes.
Okay. David, you know, let's talk about the Amazon for a second, what's happened to it. I imagine you had to see some of it down there. We hear different stories about the deforestation, and it becomes a political argument. It's greatly exaggerated. It's not that bad. It's the environmentalists who are using this for their own political purposes. What did you see? Not only what's happening to the forest, but to the peoples out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a my view is very micro in that it's kind of what I saw and experienced. And so, as I described, I would bring Fawcett's letters with me. And early in my trip, I would be reading Fawcett's letters where he would be describing kind of hacking through the wilderness. Raleigh at that point was very sick, and I would look out in some of these areas, and there was literally nothing there. It looked like Nebraska. I mean, all these areas have been cut down as far as you could see to the horizon, and were being converted into soybean farms. Interestingly enough, the areas where the forest remains greatest is in these indigenous areas. And so once I went into the Xingu area, where Heckenberger was doing his research, there the forest remains intact. But many of the native populations, these indigenous communities, feel constantly threatened under assault from loggers coming in and deforesting the surrounding area. There was a dam being built downriver from where the Xingu area, and when I was there, some of the tribes were very worried about what that would mean to their way of life.
You ever hear any stories about Fawcett reporting giants, strange tribes, strange people out there?
Yeah, his accounts, it's interesting. Fawcett's accounts of the tribes he would meet are very, are very well observed. And he would describe, people as you would imagine. Sometimes tribes that he would hear about that were kind of beyond were filled more with legend. And sometimes they probably had some basis. Like he would describe there was a tribe of very small people in some of his writings. And that quite likely could have been the Yanomami or some of these other tribes that are much shorter in stature that might have come from. So the tribes that he encountered, he never described tribes that he encountered being either enormous giants or small in stature, but he would often describe hearing legends of such people, in the distance.
Yeah, I read this account, and you're not too harsh on him. You're very realistic in painting a picture of what kind of guy he was. I mean, if he were in an officer, say, in Vietnam, he'd be the kind of guy that might get fragged, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, he was a tough guy. He was a tough bugger, and he was, he was also very contemptuous of some of the people who went with him, he never let anything stand in his way, and he's a very eccentric character. He was a complex individual.
Contemptuous in the way of if somebody couldn't keep up with him, and he was maniacal in this.
Oh, he was maniacal.
They just weren't worth going along.
That's right. I mean, he saw weakness as almost a measure of your character.
Okay, let's shift gears for a second. The Devil in Sherlock Holmes. This is your more recent book, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful connection here. This is a dozen stories, all true stories, all mysteries, elements of intrigue, characters who in many ways are sleuths trying to kind of figure out what's going on in their life. There's a story about a con man who suddenly suspects he may be the one who is being conned. There's a story of a Polish detective Again, these stories are all true, but it's the story of a Polish detective who is investigating whether a postmodern novelist has planted clues to an actual murder in his book. And the title of the book comes from a story about the death of the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar, the mysterious death this man was found garroted. And interesting enough, it was in the course of researching that, where I was reading everything about Conan Doyle, that I came across Fawcett's name, which actually led to The Lost City of Z.
And this one hasn't been bought up by Brad Pitt already, has it?
It hasn't been bought up, but several of the stories actually have been bought up by others.
Well, best of luck to you. Maybe we'll I haven't read it yet, but I look forward to reading it, and maybe we can have you back on. I'm going to go back to the phones. First-time caller, Steve in Highland Falls, New York. Hi, Steve.
Good evening. How are you doing, guys?
Okay.
Awesome. I'm actually a fan of Fawcett's for a little bit of a different reason, and I apologize if you spoke about this because I missed the first hour of the radio program, gentlemen. Fawcett, his son Brian actually published a lot of his memoirs in Britain, and he was credited and he is known throughout the Herpetological Society for encountering giant snakes in the Amazon. And in 1907, near the Rio Abuna in Brazil, he claimed to have encountered a 50 to 60 foot anaconda. He was also involved with the sighting of what is not credited as being the world's largest snake, but it's given some credence in herpetological and zoological societies.
Actually, David writes about that. You write about the snake, right?
That's right. I do. I write about the snake. And in fact, there's a drawing I also include from the son, Brian, who imagined this encounter with a snake. And,
wow.
And Fawcett had reported this snake, part of it being submerged, and he estimated, I think you said it was 57 or 59 feet.
It was phenomenal. And he was shot down. Actually, his son Brian actually had to defend him in Britain because they tried to bash his dad and his family name. And he staunchly defended him, and it was a phenomenal story. There's other stories of him encountering crazy wildlife and other things like that, and I just wanted to call and comment on that.
Sure.
And thank you, sir. You take care, gentlemen.
I mean, the snake is an interesting thing because, you know, I interviewed a lot of, I don't even know what the term is for snake experts, maybe what he said that word.
Herpetologist, I guess.
Herpetologist, is that what it is? Maybe it's herpetologist, but or zoologist, who said that, you know, the largest anaconda, I think, on record, I mean, there are different estimates, but I think it's about 27, 28 feet, where scientists say, you know, that is factually accurate. And so, did Fawcett see one this big? Did he exaggerate? Did it seem that big? You know, we just don't know for sure.
You were guessing in the book that maybe it was 27, 28 feet long,
that's
what it was submerged.
There's been no recorded account of a snake, of an anaconda, you know, more than 30 feet.
But 27, 28 feet, that's a big snake.
That would seem damn big to me. It would make me run the other way.
Yeah, I'd get out of the water right about there. West of the Rockies, Brad in Utah. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Excellent program tonight. A question for your guest. In your research going into either Fawcett's writings or other sources, did you uncover any mention of underground tunnels? That's something that shows up every now and then on the Internet, of vast, ages-old underground tunnels that stretch all the way south along the Andes to the Atacama Desert. And I wondered if you found any evidence that substantiated that in the maps or the notes that Fawcett had.
Or maybe to expand the question as well, Brad, any kind of underground installations or buildings or homes or whatever?
I did not find any evidence of this, and I don't believe that I found descriptions. I'm trying to search my memory now. Did Fawcett in any kind of passing? I do not recall Fawcett describing such a place. But when I described earlier these mystics who I met up with in the Brazilian Amazon, they believe very much in this, that this exists and that there's a portal under there and that this elaborate network of tunnels exists. I never saw any evidence of it. People who, a lot of mystics believe Fawcett did find such a place and it led to a portal, but I never found any evidence of this. But I spoke with people who very much believe that.
Brad, thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Michael in Texas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Great to talk to you. enjoying the show immensely. I've been an Amazon guide for since 1989.
Wow.
I'm up here with my father for he's doing medical therapy and stuff like that. You were talking about snakes a while ago. In 1914, Teddy Roosevelt, of course, put up a reward for $50,000 for any snake over 10 meters long.
Right.
It's not being claimed yet.
And Roosevelt was down there, right? He was down there.
Oh, yeah, he was. River of Death was a book that featured him in it. And we did a lot of research down there looking for the snakes. And getting back to Fawcett, of course, one of the biggest airlines out of Peru was Fawcett Airlines.
That's right.
And great little airlines. Unfortunately, they went bankrupt. And
named for Fawcett?
Yeah, it was named for
named
Fawcett.
For Fawcett, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was actually an international airline. It flew from Iquitos, out of right there in the heart of the Amazon, to Miami nonstop.
And when you look on some maps, too, like the, you talk a little bit about the legacy of Fawcett's legend. We talked a little bit about that. But there's a part in the Brazilian area where Fawcett's map that still appears on the map as often as Fawcett Country.
Right, exactly. And we're based out of Iquitos. And we were the first people to go in and make the first outsiders to go in and make a contract with the Guanani Nation. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yes, I am, yeah.
Yeah, we were the first outsiders to go in and make a contract with them. And our contract included that we would train them in tourism to free them from the oil companies and lumber companies. And to make them independent of them, and after 5 years of employing them and teaching them in tourism, ecotourism, we turned our company over to them and then moved out of Ecuador and into Peru. And we were some of the pioneers in ecotourism down there. You mentioned something about cleared areas like the size of the state of Nebraska down in, I guess, in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar with that. I've been all the way from the Ucayali, where the Ucayali and the Marañón meet, all the way down the Amazon to Belém to the island till we tasted salt water, and then flew back crisscrossing the Amazon up from there. Where is that area located at?
That area is in the Mato Grosso area.
That's farther south.
Yeah, it's farther south, and it's Mato Grosso actually means dense forest, but it's an area where the Brazilians have developed a lot of soybean farms.
Right, exactly. We were also one of the first people to ever go in and do reforestation in the Amazon in the early 70s.
And how's that going?
Is going great. Of course, it put us out of business. Everybody said that, nah, you never make any money out of that. Well, after the first year and a half, everybody said, wow, they're making money. And, so we got out of the business because we couldn't make any money at it anymore, but everybody else got in there trying to make money. And it's wonderful to hear you on there, and I'll pick up your book.
Thank you.
If I could possibly, do you have a website by any chance?
I do. Yeah, davidgrand.com. I think it's on the show's website too, I believe.
Okay, great. I'll get in touch with you.
Sounds good.
Okay,
thanks, Michael. Thanks. Appreciate the call. You know, you wonder. He was talking about tourism and the opportunities for ecotourism. There's all kinds of stuff, I guess, that could be left to discover there. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, it's not like it was in Fawcett's day, but there's a heck of a lot of territory down there that that humans have, I mean, at least Westerners, have not been on the ground and looking around, medicine possibilities, other kinds of discoveries.
Without question. I mean, these discoveries, too, are coming very fast in the last few years. And, you know, what people forget often is just how enormous and a vast terrain we're talking about. It's literally the Amazon basin. It's about the size of the continental United States.
Wow. I wonder, David, if now the success of your book and the impending movie, if you are basically going to set off a new round of Fawcett Freaks.
Well, my hope is that I've kind of, in reading the book, have cast enough light on these mysteries that I would be the last Fawcett freak, but somehow I doubt that, and I suspect there will be others soon marching off.
Yeah, I would imagine there will be people showing up at the Royal Society. Hey, can I see the notebooks? And
I suspect so.
And driving them crazy.
I suspect so. And I get, to be honest, I get a fair amount of emails from people saying, I'm ready to go. Give me coordinates.
Really? I mean, that. Tell me about a little bit about the reaction to the book. It's been out for a while now, and I'm sure it's done well to be picked up for a movie. But what it's been like, the kinds of fan mail or hate mail that you get?
You never know when you do these things, and you know, there's always an element of trepidation when you spend many years on this, and then you release it. And for the most part, the reception has been a very positive. And I think, you know, part of it is, and I think just, you know, in our conversation is that, and one of the things that drew me to this story is that it just taps into a lot of our myths. And it is at some level a great story and a great yarn. And I think we all, you know, have these kind of desires to kind of see what's on the other side of the horizon. And then I think this element, of these discoveries, which we're only at the beginning of, not only are transforming our view of Fawcett, but they're really transforming our understanding of what the Americas looked like before Columbus. So, for the most part, I've been very gratified in the response.
David Grand, thanks very much. The book is called The Lost City of Z. I sure recommend it for anyone who's interested in this sort of thing. And David, I hope we can have you back on some other time.
That was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.